Hear your favorite NFL legends sharing their stories and insights every week right here on Thursday Night Tailgate with Chris Mascaro and Bob Lazeri. Take it away, guys.
When the door is locked, there's no way out.
All right, now back in making his fifth appearance with us is Colts defensive line coach Brian Baker. Let me remind you about Brian's background. He's from Baltimore, Maryland, played his college ball at the University of Maryland, where he helped the Terrapins win the ACC conference title in 1983. The following year, he became a graduated assistant coach at Maryland after graduating with his degree in marketing. His resume, I'm telling you folks, is absolutely amazing. 30 years, you know, being a coach in whether it's college ball or it's in the NFL. He's been at places like Maryland, Army, Georgia Tech, the Chargers, Lions, Vikings, Rams, Panthers, Cowboys, Browns, Redskins, and then most recently at Mississippi State, then at Alabama, and now in Indianapolis with the Colts. And I'm telling you folks, the guy has the fountain of youth in his backyard. Because for a guy that's been coaching for over 30 years, he barely looks like he's 30 years old. And we are very honored he is back with us again tonight here on Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, Coach, how are you?
How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're fantastic. Thank you. So, Brian, you know, when you look at where you've been over the last few years, it's been a whirlwind. You're at Mississippi State and you coach them up. You go over to Alabama and you coach them up. And now you go to Indianapolis and boy, you make one of the, you know, best, you know, certainly front fours and, you know, arguably front sevens in the NFL. It's been a lot over the last few years. Catch us up. How's it been?
Well, it's been great. You know, it's always a blessing to, number one, be working anywhere and then be somewhere where you've got a chance to coach some talented players and help them achieve, you know, different things and try to maximize their ability. So it's been good. It's been, as you said, it's been a whirlwind since the last time I talked to you guys. I guess I was at Mississippi State. And prior to that, a couple of different pro teams. I can't even remember them all. But going back to college was a real interesting experience after being in pro ball for so long and then coming, you know, having the opportunity coming back here has been really fantastic.
And Brian, to your point, right? I mean, we hear an awful lot about, you know, coaches trying to make the leap from college to the NFL and you've sort of been back and forth. How different is the game? How hard is it to go from being a coach in the NFL to coaching college kids and now, you know, adjusting again back in the NFL?
Well, the coaching part, really isn't that different. I mean, obviously, you know, as a coach, you always have to tailor how you teach and what you teach and how to get it across because, you know, you got to get it across to everybody from the least in the room to the top of the room. So you better have a couple of different ways to get it done. So from that standpoint, that's not that big a difference. The biggest difference would be the variance in pro ball. For example, you know, you'll have a rookie. And then, you know, like this year, I had Justin Houston, who was, I believe, a 10-year veteran. So, you know, and you've got to be able, and you've got to get them both on the field to play at a similar level, or at least the same level, meaning at the best that they can play. So, you know, I call it, you know, having the ability to be an elementary school teacher and also teach graduate school, and you got to do it all at the same time, from a pro standpoint. Now in college, it's not quite that big a variance because you've got, you know, a high school freshman and then a, you know, at maximum a college senior. That variance isn't quite as big. But you've got other things to deal with in college. You know, recruiting is a monster unto itself, especially, you know, in my case, being out of college for 19 years or 20 years, actually, before going back in and then going back into the SEC and recruiting in the SEC that's a jungle. So, you know, so that was really the biggest adjustment for me going from being in pro ball for so long and then going back to college. And this transition has been fantastic.
And Brian, you've helped build a heck of a, like I say, a defense there in Indy. You guys finished the regular season 8th in average yards allowed per game, 2nd in rushing yards allowed per game at 90.5, 10th in points allowed. So talk about when you look at, you know, coming in and taking over a defense and really elevating that performance. Talk about how you did that and your thoughts on the defensive side of the ball in Indy.
Well, you know, fortunately, as I said, it all starts with players. And you know, I'm really blessed to be in an organization with a guy like Chris Ballard, GM, who believes in building from the front, both offensively and defensively, back. So, we had some good players. And then, you know, we felt like we needed to build the interior part when I initially got here. And then he pulled off, in my opinion, the trade of the year by getting DeForest Buckner. That was incredible, really. He's such a special player, and you guys see that. But, you know, he multiplied by 10, and that's the kind of person he is. So when you get an opportunity to coach, and he's still relatively young. So when you get an opportunity to coach a young, talented player who's really just top-notch person, it makes it really enjoyable. And it permeates throughout the entire defense. So I thought that was a big addition. And then we had some other young players and a couple of older players. I was fortunate to catch some of the young players at the point where they were ready to ascend. They had learned just enough about playing in the league to where, you give them a few things that can help their game. They were able to apply it because they could understand what you were talking about and they could see, could put it to use. And fortunately, it worked out for them. And then Matt Eberflus, our defensive coordinator, does a great job of keeping everybody on the same page. You know, we take a lot of pride in the effort we play with on defense. And that's the thing. You look at us and the stats are what they are. But, we want to take pride in being a really physical, really fast, relentless, defense. When you look at us and the ball stops, we take pride in having at least 7 people in the frame. So I thought that whole, philosophy and then the players buying in and getting that done had a whole lot to do with us being successful.
5 questions for Brian.
Brian, it's great to speak with you again, and I want to take you back to your early coaching career. I find it very ironic for a guy from the Baltimore area and spending your youth that way, and you basically, one of your first jobs is at the Army. where Baltimore is just so aligned with the Navy barracks and everything. But, back at Army in 86, Brian, that experience, that was last time basically you coached offense, but that experience just at Army, as far as from a discipline standpoint, a lifestyle standpoint, I'm sure a lot of that still stands with you today.
Yeah, it really does. And it's funny you asked that question, Bob. People ask about your experience, and particularly, we've got a good mix of young coaches and some guys that's been around as long as I've been around. So the young guys pick your brain a little bit, and I talk about the Army in the respect that I appreciated more retrospectively than I did when I was doing it. Because you were talking about maturity and discipline. I was 24 years old, I believe 25 maybe, and the cadets were a lot more disciplined and mature than I was. I was just some knucklehead young coach going around there looking for women, and there wasn't any, so how smart I was. So that experience back then was certainly, I look at it in retrospect, and I was fortunate to be with a really good head coach, Jim Young, and Coach Young, had a very disciplined program, and then coaching the cadets was unbelievable. Those guys, when they took off that uniform and put on the headgear, they were flying, and we always had to say whoa. We never had to tell those guys to go. So being around a group of guys that appreciated playing the game as much as they appreciated playing the game as hard as they both practiced and played, that was a great thing to me to start my coaching career around.
And I got to ask you about Alabama. 33 years after the Army gig, Alabama wins another title last week, Brian. And I got to bring up Saban. Saban, we're reading about, and we already know about him being an offensive innovator. His philosophy is basically my skill players are going to be your skill players. But what makes him an overall great coach?
Well, I tell you what, and I appreciate that question. I didn't get a chance to talk to you guys last year because, you know, their policy was the assistant coaches didn't, you know, didn't do interviews and that kind of thing. And had I talked to you last year, I would have told you the reason I left Mississippi State to go to Alabama may not have been as obvious as everybody would think. But for me, it was just to find out, you know, how he did it. Just being in the profession as long as I've been, I know it was more than just players. You know, it was more than just recruiting because of the stability and the consistency of his program. How does this guy do it? And the thing that I found out was, and he said it before, but I'm here to tell you it's the truth, you know, his relentless pursuit for excellence. I mean, he really does. I think Vince Lombardi may have said it before. You know, you pursue excellence or you pursue perfection, and along the way you achieve excellence. And that's what he is. I mean, it was never about winning and losing for Coach Saban. It was always about the process. I mean, every time we'd be blowing people's doors off, but if we didn't play as well as we could play, and if the players we were responsible for didn't play as well as we could play, then, you know, you have to have a reason why, and then have a plan to make sure that didn't happen again. So, you know, and it was, I mean, he's just, his routine, expectations, first and foremost, the expectations he puts on himself. And like I said, just to see it every day, just the relentless pursuit of excellence. I mean, that's, you know, me saying it, I can't do it enough justice to see it every day, to hear every conversation. And you mentioned offense, really Coach Saban is more of a defensive guy, so he was in every defensive meeting. So we, you know, got an opportunity to spend a lot of time with him and see his, you know, philosophy on things. And it was just the consistency, you know. And, I mean, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know if I could do it like him. You know what I'm saying? I mean, just to be so disciplined, to be so disciplined that everything you did was either you were pursuing that perfection or pursuing that excellence. Or you were like cheating yourself, you know, that was just kind of his thing. So, you know, you're either pursuing it or you weren't. So I think that's what, matter of fact, I know that's the key. Cause I mean, as far as all the other stuff, you know, the X's and the O's and the practice schedule and the off season workout and all that kind of stuff. If that was the magic, then everybody would do it. And he's had some people leave his program and do it and they don't win like he does. So it's not, it's, and there were likely some things that I would say, well, hey, if I ever got a chance to run my ship, I wouldn't do these things. So in my opinion, it was something that he won in spite of. So, but just the way, and then the way that pursuit permeated through the entire program, you know, the strength and conditioning, the academic program, the training program, the meals, I mean, the nutrition, you know, it, somebody there checking to make sure guys were eating right. And I mean, it put pressure on the players too, but the players understood that when they signed up there, that they were, you know, not going to just have a good time in college because that's not what they go to Alabama for. So it's that whole thing. I mean, and that's why he just won number 7.
Brian, you've been a part of a lot of big rivalries. I mean, you go down the list of the places that you've been, a lot of big rivalries in there in the NFL. And then obviously in college, you look over the last few years, you know, Mississippi State, Ole Miss is a big rivalry, Auburn, Alabama, a big rivalry. What is the fiercest rivalry that you've been a part of over the course of your coaching career?
Well, probably the ugliest was Mississippi State and that school in the North. As they say at Mississippi State, you're not even allowed to mention the school. You just say the school up north. So, and I still got a little maroon in my blood because I love my experience there. So I'm going to refer to that school up there as the school up north. But that rivalry is legit. I mean, in that state, it's everything. And I know it's a small little humble state and full of fantastic people. But, you know, you're either maroon or you're that other color, and there's no, you know, there's no crossing the line, there's no neutrality, and it's bitter, and it's ugly. I mean, it really is. So that's for sure the ugliest rivalry I've been a part of. Probably the one that I enjoyed the most with Minnesota and Green Bay. And, you know, back in the, you know, the old black and blue division, seemed like everybody had rivals with everybody. You know, the Green Bay people considered, I guess, Chicago their rivalry. Certainly us in Minnesota, we considered the Packers our big rivals. And then we were all very competitive. Even when, you know, Green Bay was winning those Super Bowls, they could never sweep us. We were always pretty competitive with them. So, you know, so that was probably the most enjoyable one, you know, in the NFL that I've been a part of. I tell you what now, though, but this one in Tennessee is starting to brew. I don't know
is that if right?
officially be calling a rivalry, but yeah, but the Colts in Tennessee now, that's a, I mean, this is a great division, a lot of good teams, but, you know, that one right there, those two games felt a little different than the other.
And Brian, when you look at all the things that your team achieved, your defense achieved this year, as you guys go kind of off into the off season now, you know, how long do these guys get to, you know, get to rest? You know, when is preparation officially start for the 2021 season? And what are you asking your guys to do over the off season?
Well, it really has already started, from a standpoint of, you know, I mean, kind of telling them to rest is part of it. And then giving them some things that as they start to amp up, some things that they can work on, individually, from a skill set standpoint, whether it be, you know, the bodies, you know, the nutrition, that part of it never really stops, or actually, you know, technique. I've got a couple of guys that, you know, I've challenged them with improving their flexibility and hand quickness and a couple of things that they were doing there. And those are things that are really low investment from the standpoint of it doesn't really take a big toll on their body, but they can really improve their game, by doing those things. So, you know, it really never stops. I mean, it's the professional league, and obviously guys have a very small window of opportunities to perform and, to be compensated. So they want to maximize all their time if they're smart. But rest is important for sure. Maybe a more direct question to you, answer to your question as far as the calendar, you know, sometime in April, I have a feeling this year is going to be very similar to last, and that a lot of the spring off season is going to be virtual. So, you know, having those guys have a plan for how to prepare themselves is going to be really important.
Brian, one thing that I've wondered when I look at the college game versus the NFL, and not just from X's and O's and that sort of thing, but from a player safety standpoint, we see offensive linemen, defensive linemen, you know, wearing knee braces almost all the time at the college level. But they don't do it in the NFL. You know, I why not? I mean, offensive linemen aren't running down the field outside of screen plays, and D linemen probably aren't going to catch somebody that's gone, you know, beyond them 5 or 10 yards. How important those guys are, I would think you'd want to keep those knees protected as much as you possibly can. Guys get rolled up there on the line of scrimmage. Is there a reason why we don't see those guys wearing knee braces all the time?
Well, I think it's more performance-based, especially for defensive linemen. Those knee braces are a little cumbersome. In Mississippi State, we required them to practice in them. And then for game day, you know, it was optional for the defensive line. And it was like you were taking off, you know, the governor off of a go-kart. I mean, you were letting them go. It was that big a difference for the guys. So I think it's a performance, issue for the guys. And then in college, I think it's more important because of, you know, guys are on the ground more in college. Like you watch a good pro practice. You hardly ever see guys on the ground. And then in games, you know, it's a lot more, relatively speaking, control just because of the athleticism. Where in college, you know, you've got a bigger degree of variance of, you know, athleticism, particularly with the line. So you get guys falling around and falling in awkward spots. Guys can't protect themselves as well. So I think in college it's a lot more important.
Bob Moore for Brian?
Yeah, Brian, I mean, I think I might have asked you this last time. For a guy that's done it over 35 years, and of course you've seen everything geographically. That's part of a coach's resume is to just basically work everywhere. But you know, you've had a wife and three daughters, and how tough is it been on your family? You must have an incredibly understanding family. And is there a secret recipe for keeping it together?
Well, and I appreciate that question because it gives me a chance to brag on my family. Number one, I mean, I married up, man. I married a fantastic wife, fantastic woman. My wife's name is Nevada. She, I mean, she was tailor-made for this. I didn't know it while we were dating by any stretch of imagination. I'd have married her sooner, probably. But she's been fantastic. She's been really the linchpin for the family, because of the time and those kind of things. I mean, these moves, you know, I pack up an office, you know, get on a few clothes, get on a plane and go and get started working in a new office and a new group of guys where, you know, she's got to get the house moved and packed up and doing this and find different places for the kids and do this and that. And my girls, really, by the grace of God, they have been no ill effects. I mean, I've got one that a couple of springs ago graduated from Emory University with a master's degree in public health. She's currently working with Emory University and doing some stuff with the CDC with this COVID thing. And then my middle daughter was a track scholarship athlete at the University of Virginia, record holder in the hammer throw. And she's currently in her second year at Georgetown Law. And then my youngest daughter, I call her baby girl. She gets upset when I do that. But my baby girl, because she is my baby girl. My baby girl is just finished her first semester as a freshman at the University of North Carolina, straight A student, and she's doing real. Matter of fact, she's in your all's world. She's one of the few freshmen accepted right away in their school of communications, and she wants to get into broadcast journalism. So, and she's doing really well. So, number one, you know, by the grace of God, they're really gifted girls, and that. Now, the side effect of them, and you might find this interesting, is that, you know, they get the yips if there's someplace too long. I mean, so it's a weird deal. They can't envision staying in one place, raising a family in one place and doing all of that. I said, well, that's normal. They're like, well, it's normal for us. And they, you know, so they, you know, the moving around has kind of got them feeling like that's the way they want to have their lives go too, which, you know, I don't know if I want that for them or not, but it is an interesting side effect of what they've gone through.
And one last quick question, Brian. You spent the 96 season in San Diego coaching that defense, and that was when Junior Seau was basically in his prime. There's a Hall of Famer. We all know what happened to him and everything, but have you ever come across a player with that kind of motor?
Well, it's funny you say that. You know, the young man that's on our defense now, Darius Leonard. Darius plays with a passion. He really does. And he has a lot of that fun that Junior had. I mean, he loves football and it's infectious like it was with Junior. So it's really funny you asked that question because I thought about that as I got to know and got to be around Darius more. Totally two different kind of players, with the exception of both of them were tremendously productive. You know, I mean, Junior was a physical freak, you know, 6'3" or 6'4", whatever he was. If I remember correctly, 250 or close to it, could run like a deer, strong as an ox, you know, could knock a hole in the wall, but also run with, you know, the fastest receiver. I mean, he was a physical, you know, one of the most physically gifted football players in any positions I've ever been around. But he played with a passion. First one on the field, last one to leave, you know, just, you know, you had to throw him off the field, kind of thing. It took, you know, one that always took snaps on the service team. You know, and they had to throw him out of practice because he'd be wrecking practice for the offense because he's out there doing what he does and not what the opponent, you know, so supposed to be simulating. But Junior loved football, and I see that in Darius. I mean, Darius just loves football. He runs with a passion. He plays with a relentless motor. He's really productive. He's a really instinctive guy, and I think he's got tremendous upside. I really do. So although those two guys play the same position but a different skill set, you know, that's what they have in common. I'm not ready to say that, you know, Darius is going to be a Hall of Famer like Junior, but I do feel comfortable saying he's well on his way and has a very good start at things.
Brian, just a couple more before we let you go. And something that we alluded to a little while ago, but it sort of feels like you're coming full circle as a guy who, you know, grew up in Baltimore, and now here you are with the Colts. Does it heal anything? I mean, were you one of the folks that were completely heartbroken when the Colts left town, back in the 80s, and now here you are?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny. I've talked to Carly, Mr. Hersey's daughter. She's around quite a bit. Mr. Hersey's kind of stayed away because of the COVID and all that kind of thing. But she's around. She's around all the time, and really sharp. Really, obviously passionate about her team and about our team. But anyway, she's a little younger, so she was really young when they moved up here. Well, I was in college. I was the older guy. And I remember the Mayflower truck. I remember all of that. And I remember most my dad, you'd have thought he lost a loved one. Cause I used to work at the stadium. I actually worked on 33rd Street Memorial Stadium. So, after playing on a Friday night, or Saturdays, whenever I game, so on Sundays, I would go and, really, I don't know how good I was telling anything, but I was in the stands watching the games most of the time. But I would work at the stadium, did it for the Oriole games too and all that. So, I felt tied, where we came in to work was the same interest that the players came in. So, I would see Burt Jones and those guys and some of those great Colts. Well, now in our facility, we've got pictures of all those old Colts, the ones I remember seeing, and also the ones my dad told me stories about, Big Daddy Liscombe and all those guys, obviously Johnny Unitas. They've got just so many great players. And so walking to those halls every day and seeing either the pictures or the jerseys of those guys, it really does stir something in me. And it's, I feel really blessed to be working for this organization. And it's kind of, you said, around the full circle, obviously being here at Indy, where they took the Colts, right, from Baltimore and brought them here. I also worked for the team that the original Colt, or that the Colt that the Ravens now came from, being the Cleveland Browns. So I kind of, worked in Cleveland, then Indy. The one place I haven't worked in was my hometown, and that's Baltimore. And trust me, I don't want another move, so. I'm good if that never happened.
Not enough.
So, I'm good with it too, because I like you an awful lot, Brian. But if you ended up in Baltimore with the Ravens as a Steeler fan, that'd be hard. That'd be hard for me.
Oh, I got you. Yeah, that's a good rivalry too, for sure.
Right.
But it's
well, Brian.
Great organization, Mr. Hersey, Chris Ballard. Of course, Frank Reich and I were teammates, and to see him as a head coach has been incredible too. So, again, it's a real blessing to be here.
Well, Brian, it's hard for us to imagine. Tonight's our 426th episode of the show, and you first joined us all the way back on episode 44 back in July of 2012. It's been an honor to know you for over 8 years now, 8.5 years now, and you've been a great friend of the show. Every step of the way. So we can't thank you enough for 8.5 great years as a part of this show. You're fantastic, my friend. Thank you for being here tonight.
Well, Chris and Bob, I appreciate you guys. Congratulations on the success of the show. I enjoyed listening to Joe Cooney. I remember when he was fighting. So it's always good to hear those old guys too. But again, best of luck. And you guys know I'm here whenever you need me.
We appreciate you, Coach. Take care. All the best to you and your family. Stay safe over the offseason. We look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you very much. You have a good day.
See you, Brian. That's a great Brian Baker, Bob. Guy that is, like I say, 30-plus years of coaching. And again, take a look at this picture. I mean, it's he must have started coaching when he was like 5. I mean, the guy just looks fantastic for as long as he's been in the league. And when I say... Just look back just over the last 3 years. I mean, he gets to Mississippi State, and they're one of the top, defenses in the country, and we know how tough the SEC is. But you look at the impact that he made, on that team. I mean, again, a team that gave up greater than 14 points this season, the season he was there, only 4 times all season. That's how great their defense was. And then we know he goes over to Alabama. and how great they are. And then his impact on the Colts, absolutely outstanding coach, and what a great guy.
No, it's been too long since we talked to him, Chris. And, he's been successful. Like you said, his defenses get better wherever he goes, but he's coached everywhere geographically, every part of this country. You talk about a guy, and what a great story about his family and how they've stuck together all these years. But his resume, and you expect a rather lengthy resume from guys that have been around that much, but he goes beyond the call with the geography part of it. So, it's so good to see that he's had success back at the pro level now, and I'm sure he's still passionate. I don't know how long he can keep doing it, Chris, but he seems to be in very, very good shape and still has that passion.
All right, folks. Bob and I will be turning on our Thursday night tailgate spotlight on the positive. We're going to do that right on the other side of this real quick station break.